So to start, I have no financial relationships to disclose. So what I'm going to be talking about, I think, fits well with the other presenters, because I'm really going to be talking about an example, sort of an in-the-weeds example of these kinds of privacy and big data protections that we're discussing. And while Ray sort of touched on the problems with identifiability of accompanying information that goes with the data, I'm really going to be talking about the identifiability of the data itself. So first, just to clarify, I'm here speaking on behalf of the Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues. And what the commission is, President Obama created this Bioethics Commission in November 2009, and it's to advise him on bioethical issues that may emerge as a consequence of advances in biomedicine and related areas of science and technology. And the commission really focuses its work on potential impacts and advances in research, healthcare delivery, or any area of science and technology. And we get our charges several different ways. Some come from the president himself. We've had one from the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And the commission also has the opportunity once in a while, when they don't ask us to do other things, to pick its own topics. And what I'm going to talk about right now is actually commission chosen topic. So this is the Bioethics Commission, and this is just to sort of give you a sense of the diversity of viewpoints that the commission brings to its work. It's chaired by Amy Gutman, who's the president of the University of Pennsylvania, and vice-chaired by Jim Wagner, who's the president of Emory University. I'm not going to go through everybody, but I just want to give you a sense that it's this very diverse grouping of lawyers and philosophers and clinicians and government employees and academics. So they really bring a lot to the table. The Bioethics Commission thus far has put out 5 reports over a very diverse range of topics, the first being on sort of the ethics of synthetic biology, the next 2 focusing on human participant research protections, and then the most recent one on ethical medical countermeasure research in a pediatric population. And what I'm going to focus on today is the Privacy and Progress Report in Whole Genome Sequencing, which came out in October 2012. And I'm going to focus in particular for this conference on the Commission's discussion on protecting individual participants in big data and how some of the Commission's recommendations can actually be applied to the biobank setting. So what really set up this as a potential topic of real interest to the Commission is this sort of tension that perhaps exists from the fact that, so when genetic research began, it was really focusing on finding individual variants that sort of were directly associated with a genetic disease with really high penetrance, so things that were sort of the low-hanging fruit of genetic research. For example, Tay-Sachs disease is one of those things. However, as genomic medicine has advanced, really what we're seeing is that the sort of new frontier is looking over sort of the whole genome or large exome sequencing and looking how different variations throughout the genome interact with different environmental variants and then sort of result in disease or other healthcare differences. And this type of research really requires this access to this fairly broad swath of data across populations and across demographics to really sort of be able to take those bigger picture issues into consideration. However, the individuals who contribute genomic data to these research databases typically don't see direct benefit for themselves. Like, they might be interested in the disease under research, but it's rare that it's actually going to turn around and they're actually going to receive that direct benefit in their time. I think one interesting example is Canavan disease, which is a pediatric disease that affects the pediatric population. And actually, families got together. It's an orphan disease, so it doesn't affect very many people. But this population was able to get together and collect all of this bio data across sort of 500 families across the world and actually support researchers locating the genetic variant that was associated with Canavan disease. So it can be done. But generally, that is not a benefit that people who contribute end up getting. And so you're sort of left with this ethical conundrum of where donors can be possibly risking individual privacy to advance this science for the public good that we all appreciate. So the commission sort of, it doesn't go off and do its deliberations in a closed room. It really sort of embraces deliberative democracy and sort of getting as much information as possible from other experts out there in the field. And they held 4 public meetings and heard testimony from many different preeminent speakers. They also surveyed all 18 common rule agencies in the government that might be conducting genetic or genomic research. They put out a request for information in the Public Federal Register, and then they also did a lot of consulting with preeminent experts in the field. So we got a lot of diverse information. And I just thought that this was kind of interesting and sort of something unique that the President's Bioethics Commission can do is sort of surveying the government in a way that I think many individual researchers at institutions would be envious of. So I did want to highlight this data that we were able to collect. And the Bioethics Commission found that 6 of the common rule agencies currently sponsor genetic or genomic research. And that includes the Department of Defense, the Department of Health and Human Services, probably most obviously, the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Transportation. So I think some of these are not as obvious as others why they would be conducting genetic research. So as an example, the Department of the Defense collects genetic data for their DNA dog tag program. I don't know if any of you have heard about this, but it's actually taken mandatory samples from every member of the armed forces since 1991. And they only use it to identify remains of fallen soldiers. And it can't be used for any other purposes unless approved for the Assistant Secretary of Defense. So it's a very narrow usage, but it's interesting to know that they're actually collecting genetic data. And all of those agencies, and the Department of Veteran Affairs also collects data. And all of those agencies, but for the Department of Homeland Security, actually maintain or support biorepositories or databases. I do want to note at this point, so when we're talking about biorepositories and databases, those can be either or. And generally, in the government, as well as academic institutions, we're actually talking about databases. So these people aren't keeping the biospecimen samples. You know, you don't have rows and rows of blood spots like Dexter keeps in his. But, you know, they're actually sort of keeping the data, because once you peel the data out, the data themselves are actually much more useful than the biosamples themselves. So just to talk a little bit about the scope of the commission's report, it did make very clear that while it was talking specifically about whole genome sequencing, because it sort of felt that that was really the future of genetic research and large-scale exome sequencing, the point was that the ideas and the ethical values behind this apply broadly to all large-scale genetic and genomic data. And the aim of the report was to accommodate future advances, because obviously the point of the Bioethics Commission is to be helpful, and we don't want to come out with reports and information that would be outdated within months. So they really tried to keep this sort of broad, general, ethical principle analysis that really could sort of apply as the science continues to advance. And then also did want to make clear that while, of course, practical and legal considerations are always important, that our ethical obligations might actually reach beyond that which is legally enforceable. So that is also a point that they wanted to make, that some of what they're talking about, we're not just talking about the laws and regs. Really what we're talking about is that which is most ethically laudable. So some of the key findings which really support and reinforce a lot of the research about participant preferences that has already been conducted in this area, but some of the key findings that the commission came to was, as some of our previous speakers have pointed out, current U.S. governance and oversight of this genetic and genomic data don't always fully protect individuals from risk. And as Ray actually also spoke about, you know, realizing the promise of this whole genome sequencing really requires widespread public participation, and widespread public participation requires people being comfortable that they're going to be protected. And therefore, all future policies really need to reconcile this tension between anticipated societal benefits and potential privacy risks to individuals. So as Will really talked to us about, there are lots of potential limitations to HIPAA, but one that I want to highlight in the case of genetic and genomic research is how it defines identifiability. And it defines it as something that is readily identifiable or easily identifiable for the person looking at it, and so it would be something obvious associated with data like name or social security number or picture, or in some circumstances, like you discussed, the right zip code with the right, you know, month of birth, that kind of thing that can be put together to make the person obvious and apparent. The human subject's research protections, for example, informed consent, IRB review, some of the things that I'm sure you all are very familiar with, are actually only triggered, it's only counted as human subjects research participation if the data itself is or might readily be identifiable. So you're not even considered to be conducting human subjects research if you're working with de-identified genetic data currently. However, the interesting thing about genetic and especially genomic data, like the more we have of it, is genomic data is completely uniquely identifiable. So you might not know exactly which person on Earth the genome belongs to, but you know it only belongs to one. And so the more information, you know, the big data, the more information that we're gathering and creating, the 80% in the past 5 years, the more likely it is that you're going to have the key readily accessible to re-identify this unique data. And in fact, this was a very timely debate for the commission to be having, because while the Bioethics Commission report came out in October 2012, just 3 months later, Melissa Gimrick and several other researchers from the Whitehead Institute debate for the commission to be having, because while genealogy databases and plain old internet searches to deduce the identity of nearly 50 research participants who supposedly private genetic data had been de-identified and stored in large publicly available databases. So this was data that had been contributed, de-identified, put in a public database that they were able to go back in with the information that was available on the internet and decode them. And they actually came out to themselves with a list of 50 people. They didn't actually publish it, but they were able to figure out who they were. And they also predicted, they didn't do this, but they predicted that they could recover the surnames of approximately 12% of U.S. Caucasian males in this fashion, because apparently that's who most often uses these genealogy websites. So people had been really talking, and experts who had come to testify had said, this is coming, this is coming, this is coming. But this was really, you know, the hypothetical had suddenly become very real. And as I mentioned, we had a lot of people come and speak to us at our meetings, and I really like this quote from John Willibanks, who's the founder of Consent to Research. And he said at our meeting in San Francisco, "Harm is not the act of distributing data. Harm comes from actions that are taken once the data has been distributed." And, you know, as a staffer listening to that, I was like, huh. You know, I really had to think that through. And I think that the commission really sort of ended up embracing that thought process, which I think takes a minute, but really makes sense. And I think an example is probably helpful. So if you consider an individual who volunteers for a research study of genomic data that's supposed to be stripped of like traditional identifiers and some sort of error occurs, and this person's genetic data along with their name ends up posted in a database in a public repository for some limited amount of time, but think about it, that no researchers ever access the database during that time and no one ever sees the data and it's just taken down. And compare that to a Utah male with Eastern European ancestry who is one of the 100 volunteers to contribute his data to the 1,000 Genomes Project, who is now among the names that Gimrick et al. Have decoded along with his genome. Both people were identifiable, but the persons whose identity was never accessed clearly has more privacy. And so it's really this parsing out of the differences between identifiability and actual privacy. So the commission decided to really focus on then how do we secure privacy? And there's really several steps that go into privacy. One, and sort of the ethical tools that you have to use to to ensure people's privacy. And some of the steps are, one, the individual has to decide to disclose information, so there's privacy considerations there, and they need to make an active decision. Another is people's access to that data, right? So whether an individual researcher or a group of researchers are allowed into that database and can access that data. But the third part is then what do researchers do with that data? Because certainly they have access rules, but then how do they actually use that data that they've otherwise accessed? And then the couple of ethical tools, so there was a lot that the commission discussed in this report, but I'm going to focus on for our talk here today about big data, is specifically informed consent, which really gets to disclosure, access, and appropriate use. So, you know, when you disclose, what were you consenting to, what kind of access were you consenting to, what kind of use were you consenting to, but also what kind of data protections need to be in place in case the consent doesn't work and the data are actually misused. So the ethical ideal that the commission put forth in its report was to obtain consent for data, even for genetic data, even if it is going to eventually be de-identified. Because of the many reasons that I've highlighted here, it really thought that we should step back from worrying about identifiability and really be like, every time it is appropriate to get full consent. And in fact, this goes along the same lines as the current ANPRM for the Common Rule, which proposes, and I quote, "Categorizing all research involving the primary collection of biospecimens, as well as storage and secondary analysis of existing biospecimens, as research involving identifiable information." And so really sort of going back to when it begins, when you first contribute the genomic information and data to the biobank, that's the integral point at which to get the informed consent. And that informed consent would and generally does include the risk of misuse. However, just warning people, as they did for the people who ended up in the Gymrich et al. Study, that it's possible that your data could be re-identified is not enough. You can't just say, you know, it's possible, and then if it happens, be like, oh, we told you so. You know, so we actually have to do additional work to strive to prevent those risks whenever and wherever possible. And sort of the greater potential for harm might not actually be sort of this illegitimate access to a biobank, where a lot of the deliberations before this have been focused, but rather the misuse of the data that had otherwise been legitimately accessed. And the commission really found that it's the responsibility of those that fund and support big data and biobank research to sort of really work to outline acceptable access to and permissible use of identifiable whole genome sequence data. So really sort of the take-home point of this report in conjunction with sort of big data concerns is throughout the ethical, legal, and practical debate, it's sort of less about what makes something identifiable and more about what makes it private. And the most important thing is how we can protect the privacy in big data while still enabling progress. And so there's lots more information about the Bioethics Commission generally and the report on privacy and progress in whole genome sequencing specifically through all of these lovely electronic resources that our communications director has put together for you. But I'm also happy to answer any questions or take any comments. I'll take that too. Yeah?
How do you think the future is going to go with genomic information being classified as CHR?
I have. Yeah, oh. So sort of parsing out two different questions. One, I have high aspirations for the Common Rule ANPRM to become an NPRM and sort of add this layer of privacy protections for the genetic data. And so the question is, you know, does encouraging informed consent, can that bring genetic research to a halt? And sort of not the tongue-in-cheek answer, but of course ethics never brings advancements in science to a halt, right? I mean, so there always is going to have to be different logistical considerations and ways that people are going to have to find how we can practically continue to promote this progress while helping to protect privacy. But there are ways, and lots of people testified in front of us talking about sort of informed consent, maybe even through Facebook. You know, we know everybody's on it, like, and different types of consent, blanket consent, going back to having somebody's email address, you can ping them anytime a researcher wants to access and be like, do you consent to this? Do you consent to this? Or in the first blanket informed consent saying, you know, are there any exceptions to your consent? Is there a type of research you don't want to consent to? So there are some very smart people really delving deep down into the weeds on how to make this work. And I think that it will personally. Yeah. Are you going to ask me a definitional question?
What's your definition of fun? Going back towards the beginning of the presentation, I think you're balancing the needs of the individual versus the group, and that you know, for the individual to upload his or her information requires contingent upon privacy, how secure is that data. Do you guys consider also like reciprocity? I think Helen Nissenbaum from NYU talked about that, what people also might want, not just the security of the data, but that they get something from this, from it. And I didn't really see too much of that. Was that any part of your discussion at all?
Yeah, and the commission actually looked at a lot of empirical evidence concerning why people donate their biospecimens, and a lot of it was very altruistic. Like, the majority of people actually donate and become engaged in research for altruistic reasons because they honestly believe in the research enterprise. And so I don't think it was as much as tit for tat. You know, they're expecting, they really meant to contribute to this sort of future of genetic research. And perhaps it's a little bit different in cases of very specific orphan drugs that people are really hoping to benefit specifically. But in genetic research, the empirical researchers really found that people just wanted to help. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because so we actually had somebody come and testify to us specifically on the Havasupai tribe case. And actually why I think that it's a really on-point case is because sort of the entire research community came behind it and said, this is wrong. This shouldn't happen again. And so, yes, it can happen, but sort of the forward-looking point is, what can we do to prevent it from happening? And I think there's a lot of agreement that this kind of research, when people specifically consented to a certain kind of genetic research, and suddenly they're having, their predispositions to alcoholism and genetic variants associated with depression and, you know, sort of origins looked at, and that makes people very uncomfortable. And I think that is really why the commission came back to, this is why informed consent is so important. But I think it's a good point that logistically it is very challenging, and I'm not going to be able to solve all of those logistical issues, but another, to add to the logistical issues, something that we heard a couple times, which I also thought was very interesting, was sort of limitations on sample. If you're going to do all these internet-based sort of re-consent models, how that could limit your sample for people who might or might not have access to internet. And so whether you're going to have different types of consent, you know, whether consent is going to have to be tailored, whether consent is going to be tailored for the study or tailored for the participant, I think it's very complicated.
I'll just add, to connect to this issue about reciprocity, again, I go to some information in these conferences, an issue people talk about is trust, right? And so there's something, you know, sort of trying to develop relationships of trust between individuals and other entities is incredibly hard, right?
Yeah. And examples like Havasupai don't help.
No.
Yeah. Yep.
I was intrigued by what you were talking about, the Wolfgang's quote.
Yeah.
That is, the outcome you described is different, sounds different than the foundation you think we're taking.
Mm-hmm.
We did the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. I concluded by the end of that, you simply cannot play whack-a-mole with the harms.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we didn't put harm in my tech. Instead, we shoved it in the rule. It's not a bill. The problem is if you don't control data, there's limitless ways to use the data. Now, what you were just talking about on consent, that is possible. You don't have to come back again and again.
Mm-hmm.
There's this respective rule in the final privacy rule that came out in January, which allows you HHS to do a great job of it, but if you were doing a biobank study, for example, you draw a line around the purposes of sound. The guidance is vague and brief, but it basically says that investigator has to do this in such a way that your participants could anticipate your use of data or biosample or the EHR data or what have you. But it has to be within that. So if you say, I'm studying diabetes, don't go out there and take the samples and study, you know, whether individual STDs, pregnancy, there's the big five we always talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the problem I have is that when you start focusing on it, the harms, you're not controlling the data. And if we wrote GINA in a way that data was supposed to stay within the HIPAA construct, it was considered PHR. That was how we treated it. But the problem with this, and I was asked the other day, about, I'm surprised no one mentioned the Henry Lacks case, is that family cannot consent. And when you share your data, you post it up on the web, you've now released your children's data. This is a really thorny thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the control, it's got to be more than simply put it in a database that people can use it, de-identify it or otherwise. Can't really like unring the bell.
Right, and I agree, and I didn't mean to de-emphasize the importance of access restrictions. They're definitely of critical importance, but I think that what people focus less on is use restrictions and say, like, well, we've limited the access, and then sort of
that rule, I think, is incredibly powerful for all of us, but I'm incredibly worried about it. We're going to implement it at Marshall, but I'm incredibly worried that people will not draw up because HHS put a big rule in. After all the things we opened up on consent, they said, okay, you can do prospective studies with businesses with data or with biosamples.
Mm-hmm.
You just know that someone out there is going to step outside the box and do something that screws it up.
Yeah, and I mean, not to parse too much, but I think that that's the difference between looking at harms versus looking at uses, too. And the commission looked at uses as opposed to harms because harms are just so subjective, whereas limiting uses can be more objective. And I think the Henrietta Lacks case is a really interesting case in this example because, you know, where at first it was sort of much more of a property case and people were sort of very interested in sort of the financial interests of what was going on. Sort of recently, as you pointed out, these German researchers actually posted their whole genome and then suddenly it became a privacy issue.
Whenever I hear the word privacy,
The real issue well, it was the value that the Lacks family had as well. So
if you go back over all these presentations and you look back, the target reference is a good one. And we have a situation now where all of the 50 years of anti-discrimination statutes we have can be undermined by behavioral data pulled off commercially, by health data pulled down, and the difference is if I'm a woman or I'm an African-American, whatever, that trait is obvious. It is not obvious when you're going to your health record and making decisions that are discriminatory. And this could be a huge, you know, big data could actually be a huge way in which we undermine most of our civil rights protections. And I know that source of
I have a lot to say about that, but there's only 2 minutes.
I'm going to just don't drop that bomb.
Okay.
One more question. How about the back?
Okay. Hi.
There's an 10 seconds to rehear the question.
Did you want to take a crack at it, Will? Oh, thanks. I mean, I think that just goes back, at least in genetics, to that sort of first initial inherent tension, is that a lot of, at least, so taking away the target example, so taking marketing off the table, but if we're really talking about genetic advances, of which we've seen so many of in the past decade or so, that really does require people to be altruistic and to sort of risk some of these privacy protections. And sort of what's so critical is to be able to actually protect them, not only so that they're reassured to contribute their data, but so you're doing the right thing and you're doing the ethical thing, and that so we can actually use all of this health information to sort of advance science. And I do think it's different, though, the different kind of big data. I mean, if you're collecting the Facebook likes, versus collecting genetic information, I think it's very different, and so it's sort of important to consider them differently.
So I'm going to call it for now, and I want to thank our speakers.